when you talk about AI and you talk about technology in that situation you just mentioned, I think it's important to also note that you need to know more about engineering than just hitting enter on a computer. You need to understand what we like to say, does it pass the sniff test?
You're listening to the Building Better Futures podcast, where innovation meets inspiration. In each episode, host Eric Hirani journeys alongside notable thought leaders who are shaping the future, cultivating exceptional work cultures, and nurturing the next generation of trailblazers. We aim to spark inspiration by engaging in dialogue with leaders from groundbreaking companies, innovative projects, and exceptional teams. Our goal is to empower individuals to positively impact those around them and leave a lasting legacy of positive change in our communities and society at large. Let's dive in together and explore what it takes to build better futures, one conversation at a time.
Today, I'm joined by Arthur Alzamora, principal at Langen Engineering. Arthur is a professional and engineer, a fellow with the ASCE, a lead AP professional, and a board-certified geotechnical engineer. So I'm really excited to hear everything he has to talk to us about today. Arthur, thanks for taking the time to talk with me today. Before we get to the core conversation, I always like to start with some good news and gratitude. Are there any like professional or personal good newses or gratitudes you want to share with me in the audience?
Yeah, Eric, thanks. Thanks for the introduction. Yeah, I think sometimes we don't take time to just sit back and appreciate all the things that we have. We tend to focus on the negative because those are the problems we need to address. I appreciate my career. I appreciate what I have as a result of being an engineer. I've been able to travel the world. I've met my wife through engineering. Fortunately, I think all of our kids might end up being engineers just because they have two engineering parents. So I think a lot of what I have and where I owe it to my career, and I'm very happy and grateful for those opportunities.
Well, I'm speaking for my dad a little bit here, but if all your kids are engineers, maybe it'll be good. It'll be good.
I'm not against it. How about that?
Very cool. On show days, my gratitude is always to the guest. I appreciate you being on and taking time to talk to me. And, you know, and also to we do have a production team that's helping put together the entire show. So I always like to thank them as well. All right. Well, let's jump right into it. To start, tell us about yourself. Where'd you grow up? Where'd you go to school? How did you find yourself at Langen? What do you do at Langen? Just tell us your background.
Thanks, Eric. So I'm born and raised in New York. I spent my formative years up in the suburbs of the city up in Orange County. Went to school up here. I was very active at school, very active in sports. Then went on to a community college, which SUNY Orange, where I got my associate's degree in engineering. And then transferred to Manhattan College, where I finished up my bachelor's degree and then continued on to get my master's and focused on geotechnical engineering. I then wasn't necessarily sure what type of engineering I wanted to do. I know I was enrolled in civil engineering. I wanted to focus on structural. But then I spent some internships as a student and used those internships to build out my career and what I was interested in. And I found at firms, I had interned once at a firm called Tectonic Engineering, where I did a lot of civil engineering, spent a lot of time during percolation tests, time out in the field doing concrete cylinders and all the fun stuff. And then transitioned into an internship with a company called Musil Rutledge, which is a geotechnical firm in New York City. Learned a lot, spent a lot of time in the lab, a lot of time on site, spent a while working. I was working there while I was also in school, and using what I learned at Musil Rutledge, I was able to realize I really wanted to focus on geotechnical engineering. And then upon graduating and going to get my master's, that's when I stumbled upon Langen Engineering and was very fortunate to get a job at Langen. Langen also paid for me to finish up my graduate degree, which was fantastic. When I started at Langen, we were a very small New York City office, probably 10% of what we are now. We're close to 300 people in New York, and at the time, we were probably around 20. So all through organic growth and with a main focus on civil, geotechnical, environmental engineering. My current role is I spent my time working my way up the chain as a staff engineer. We're spending predominantly probably 7 or 8 solid years out in the field working on construction sites and investigations and whatnot. And now in my role as principal, I'm one of our co-leads of the geotechnical practice in New York City, but I also support a lot of our New York State and I'll say city work, but also outside the city, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Connecticut, and find myself also working in other states depending on the project needs and where we're pulled. So very fortunate. We have a very good group of engineers, very smart people, most of which I would say are probably much smarter and brighter than I am. I would love to take credit for some of the things that they do, but it's truly amazing. We're very fortunate to have some of the best and brightest working for us and really making guys like me look good. So thanks.
That sounds awesome. And sounds like you've had a long tenured career. I mean, going back to college, basically. You know, and I know you do work outside of New York City, but it sounds like a lot of it's predominantly New York City. Many of the firms you mentioned there are New York City-based firms. So tell me a little bit about, let's talk about New York City a little bit, extremely urban environment, right? And they continue to find new ways to build, which is so amazing, you know, for a little island. What do you see? Like, what's the future? Any innovation or innovative practices coming up that are going to maybe revolutionize the way we build for the next 20, 50 years?
So I would say that when I started working in geotechnical engineering, especially in New York City, we saw a lot of the process was prepare a set of plans, submit them to the Department of Buildings, get them approved, and then the contractor would come in and change the means and methods and do it the way they wanted to. I'd say with the advances with the building code over the last decade or so and the way the industry has went in New York City, we find the geotechnical practice specifically that we have to think outside the box and actually design and detail the drawings in a way that they can be built in a realistic manner. And they're not a set of plans that are planned to be superseded. These are plans that we're thinking of innovative ways to construct and design from. And I think that that has only really happened because the engineering and construction world have decided to essentially become more aligned. It's no longer us versus them sort of mentality. It's more of we're in this together. We need to figure out a solution forward. And just because that's the way we've always done it doesn't necessarily mean it was the best way to do it. And I think those sort of approaches have allowed us to have very innovative and outside the box type thinking, especially that not all solutions are the right solutions necessarily. We need to find the one that's perfect for that project. So I would say when I started in geotechnical engineering, when I started, we saw a lot of the modeling, advanced modeling would take a considerable amount of time. We're talking days, right? You would run an advanced computer model, you'd hit start on your computer, and then you go home for the night and hope that it would just not mess up throughout the course of the night. Come in the next morning and, oh my God, look, it worked, and then hit enter again and rerun the next scenario. I think with the advances in technology, we've now been able to take those things that used to take 3 or 4 days to run, and now we're able to do those in maybe an hour. So the advances with the technology, the advances with the computer, I would say the computers that we have in our hands with our cell phones are likely more powerful than the computers I learned AutoCAD on, you know, over 2 decades ago. So I think those sort of things have really allowed us an opportunity to expand the industry, and we get to do much more advanced thinking, much more advanced design. And I think that's where we're going to go with the future. I know for a fact there's several buildings throughout the world that are planned to be going much taller than what is currently constructed in this world. So we're starting to see advances even pushing the envelope from there. And it's been an exponential increase. If you look at what was once the tallest building in the world 30, 40 years ago, isn't even in the top 10 anymore. That just shows that there's an emphasis on these large urban towers and urban environments and pushing the envelope and seeing what we can do. And I know I'll say our brethren and sisterhood of engineers are definitely up for the task.
I think that's great. I actually, you know, it's funny. I wrote the question. I didn't even think of technology as an answer. I thought it was going to be more something about structures or materials. But I actually, a few episodes ago, we had a Joe Tulamello on from Gana Fleming. I don't know if you know him, but Joe's.
I know Joe, yeah.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about AI and technology. I think what you just spoke about in terms of the ability for us to iterate on design, right, very quickly is going to open up so many doors for the next 10, 15, 20, 30 years, decades to come.
When you talk about AI and you talk about technology and that situation you just mentioned, I think it's important to also note that you need to know more about engineering than just hitting enter on a computer. You need to understand what we like to say, does it pass the sniff test, right? Like, you need to look at a problem, and just because the computer gives you a solution, you need to quickly, with your judgment and experience, you need to understand, well, hold on, this actually isn't correct. It gives you an answer. And I think you hear of all these stories online when people are using the generated AI chat bots, and these chat systems will, if you ask them to give you a paper or some information, it will answer the problem for you. It will give you that paper. That may not actually exist, right? So you're hearing these stories where people are writing research papers and citing authors that don't exist because the computer, it just generated an answer because it could not find that paper on the internet in its search. So I think there's things that we still need to know. We still have to go through our tenure of understanding engineering and understanding these sort of problems. So this way, when we do see these real situations, we know how to properly handle them.
Well, without a doubt, I think the technical knowledge and experience is the most important piece, right? Of anything. I use ChatGPT sometimes to help me write, but I can't use that message. It doesn't sound like me. It doesn't feel like me. And half the time, it's just not correctly articulated. To your point, I know there was I think it was an attorney who actually wrote a brief. And it cited cases that did not exist, like case law that did not exist. And obviously, that's a real serious problem. So, but the other part I wanted to discuss with you about building in an urban environment that is New York City is that there's a lot of history here, right? And a lot of iconic projects. And you're saying the tallest building in the world today that was in existence 20 years ago is not even in the top 10 today, but it's still a really iconic building. How do you balance that? We got to protect the history of the city, but we also got to modernize and keep moving forward.
I think you always have to have a nod to the past, right? So you have to understand what really spurred the revolution of landmarks and the landmark preservation that we now take serious, and especially in New York City, and what some of these cultural landmarks mean for us. So just because we have a landmark in New York City that might only be 100 years old, which in Europe, that is a fairly new structure. When you see what spurred this was, we had a little bit too much development that was just focused on new building, and we didn't notice some of these beautiful structures like Grand Central. We needed to keep that in play. And it's the famous story that everyone sees now with the new train hall versus where Madison Square Garden is in the current Penn Station and what it used to look like. And thank God, if they did not take steps forward, we wouldn't have Grand Central for the way it is. And you hear about all those stories. So I think you always have to have a nod towards that. Specifically in geotechnical, though, a lot of the ground conditions were formed thousands and thousands of years ago that we have to deal with and analyze and work with. But a lot of the infrastructure, like subways, sewers, utilities, everything that we see below ground is well over 100 years old in most cases. So we're dealing with, these might not be quote unquote, say landmarks per se, but they need to be treated and protected as such. And we have to design our systems and handle everything that we do with that sort of mentality and in the back of my mind, just knowing we can't cause any sort of damage, movement, or impact to any of those below grade items. We routinely see things where city sewers that are under some of the most occupied and densely populated areas of the city are made out of stone, brick, wood. I've seen plans that call out wood sewers and whatnot. And these are 20, 30 feet in the ground in some cases. And we need to make sure that we preserve these or take proper steps to keep them intact. Now that's the unfun stuff. I'll say the fun stuff is, from a geotechnical standpoint, is regardless of the structure, a lot of what we work on, you might have an architect or a structural engineer that they focus on, say, medical facilities, or they focus on residential facilities or commercial. With geotech, we get to work on all those. We don't have this studio approach where we're just working you need somebody to design those foundations for hospitals. I don't do that. I just do colleges. That's not how we work. So we're fortunate that someone in my career, I've been able to work on a whole range of items, whether it's been several of the cathedrals in the city, St. John of Divine, St. Pat's Cathedral, Trinity Church, or working on buildings like One Vanderbilt in New York City and some of the other taller towers that we have in Hudson Yards and whatnot. Being able to work on these things are tremendous. And we're fortunate that in geotechnical engineering, we're able to do things like that, right?
This episode is brought to you by Infinite Consulting Corp, your go-to firm for MBE certified project and construction management consulting. Discover how Infinite can help you build a better future at infiniteconsultingcorp.com.
You mentioned some amazing projects in there. One Vanderbilt is magnificent. You know, I've been to, there's an Amex lounge. I forget what floor, but it's got this incredible view, but the space is amazing. And then obviously Hudson Yards, everything they've done there is just incredible. And they've reinvented the city basically since, you know, I'm a New Yorker like you, right? It sounds like you grew up in this area. Just like that, the west of Penn Station, you did not go. Why would you do that? And now it's like the nicest part of the city. You know, I go to the Brookfield properties over there, Hudson Yards over there. It's great. So spoke about a bunch of amazing projects there. And part of the show, I always like to pull out of people that, you know, as engineers, as contractors in the industry, what we're doing is for the betterment of society, right? You want to tell us about one or two projects you think really impacted, you know, the community that you worked in and you're just like especially proud of, or anything you want to highlight?
Yeah, I mean, I would say One Vanderbilt was a project that there's a bunch of projects I've worked on, whether it was a medical research facility up at Weill Cornell, several of the hospital buildings up at Columbia Presbyterian, or working on some of the most beautiful and iconic residential commercial towers in the city. I'd say One Vanderbilt has a special place in my heart because I essentially started that project, you know, while I was transitioning into a project manager. And then through that project, I became a project manager because it ran for so long. It was such a complicated site, and was a project manager and became partner at my firm. So I essentially grew with that, and I was able to see some of my direct reports, some of the folks I rely on that I consider some of my best friends. I was able to see them also grow with me on that project. So I think that was something like, it's not uncommon for us as engineers at projects that take that many years. But when you see something like that, it's quite remarkable. But that doesn't lessen the fact that I just recently completed, over the last year or so, a project in Times Square, TSX Times Square, where we were part of the team that raised the Landmark Theater 30 feet in the air. And again, as a geotech, I was involved early on before a lot of the team members were involved. And I remember meeting with several developers when they were trying to find a development partner, talking about raising the theater in the heart of Times Square, right across from the TKTS booths in Times Square. It's also iconic. And you're sitting here saying to yourself, this is the only city in the world that you might consider doing something like that. Most other folks would just tear it down or, you know, try to avoid doing the project whatsoever. And that's something that I walk around Times Square. I've been fortunate to work on a bunch of buildings in Times Square. And when you walk around, and my kids and my wife get tired of hearing me saying, oh, dad was involved with that. That was, then they're like, all right, we get it. Like, stop. But it's something to be proud of. Like, whether you have a small portion of a project over a large portion of the project, it's something you should be proud about and you should be willing to tell folks. So I think it's tough to just pick one, but overall, it's fun to walk around and know these little secret items all over New York City that most people just walk by and take for granted. So
no, it's hard. A bunch of projects I loved and appreciate and thank our clients for giving us the opportunities to work on. The TSX job you mentioned, I mean, talk about balancing historical with new modern, right? I mean, who would, like you said, nowhere other than New York City would they even think of attempting to do something like that? I mean,
no.
It's incredible. I did a tour of the site. They've done a great job. But that was really like a cornerstone piece of the project. It's amazing that they were able to do that. All right, very cool. So we talked a lot about projects in industry. I always like to spend some time also talking about the next generation, right? Yep. How are we helping current students or the newer members to our teams so that they can one day take over, right? They're going to be the next principals and project managers and vice presidents of the industry. And so as someone who has a lot of leadership positions, I know you're very involved with ASC, right? I mentioned you're a fellow. I know you're involved with ACEC. I know you're involved with the Manhattan Alumni Association, right? You're very active in that. Tell us a little bit about any advice or encouragement you have for the next generation. What do you think is important for someone coming out of school or even going into school today to know about the industry?
So it's funny, Eric, I get asked a question like that a lot. I get asked from my peers in the industry, but I also get asked when I go talk to colleges and students. A little bit of my personal story I maybe left out in the beginning was my longtime mentor, Andy Ciancia, who was our past chairman of the board at Langan, actually met me at a scholarship interview for the scholarship at ACEC. And that's how I first heard about Langan. And it wasn't shortly thereafter. I ran in a few Langan folks at a career fair, and they mentioned that Andy had met me, and it kind of all worked out perfectly. And look at this, over two decades later, I'm still here and enjoying it. I think what I like to tell the younger folks, and again, I think the term we should use emerging, because they're emerging in their career, is a lot of times they look at some folks who are a little bit further along in their career and they think that there's something vastly different with us, which I don't think there is. I think what it is, those people who are better or successful at their job, most of the time, find ways to never say no, right? They get opportunities, they always say yes. So I try to tell them, if you were very involved in college, then try to stay involved in those same groups and societies as you go into your professional career, right? So I think what you want to find time, like I was very involved in ASCE. So when I graduated, the first thing I did was find the next ASCE meeting that just happened to be the day that they were electing new officers. So that's how I got involved, is basically I became an officer of the Young Member Forum almost within the same month I graduated college, which was great. And I've been involved ever since and held every position. So I was very proud of that. But the difference is, if you're not doing this early in your career, and then when you just start a family or buy a house or do other things, it's very hard for you to add those things into your career later on. So if you're not accustomed to setting aside that time or doing these things, I've always been accustomed to being part of groups and different events and coordinating things, and because I've always done it. I've never not done it. Like, I can't think of a time where I didn't do it. And when you find yourself doing that all the time, it's not hard to make time for it because it's always been part of you. But if you're 20 years in your career and you decide, I'm going to go join this board, or I'm going to join this charity, or I'm going to start helping out with this, you're going to find it very hard because that's a new thing upsetting your regimen, so to speak. So I think my advice is, I think the students coming out of college are extremely bright. They're remarkable. First off, they know how to maneuver technology better than a lot of the people that are further in their career. They know how to work in teams. They know how to work well. Unfortunately, I think, you know, the remote environment has hampered a lot of folks, but I think we're working around that now. I think a lot of the students who spent a majority of their college career locked up in COVID, I believe that they were able to now start coming. They're coming to the office more because they were tired of sitting home and not working with alongside folks. I think it's very good. I'm very happy where we're going. And what I think, though, is folks that, I use the term emerged instead of like older, because I think people who are further along in their career or emerged into their career, I think we need to do a little bit more. We need to like build the bench. We need to find ways to give back to the colleges, give back to the different institutions, the folks that helped us out. We need to go back and lecture, guest lecture, find ways to help with tours and do whatever we can to help folks get along. And I've been happy that my tenure as ACEC chair in New York over the last year, I was able to institute a bunch of things helping to advance the community colleges where I came from. And I think we underestimate how many folks in our careers have spent time at a community college or a junior college before they went on to a four-year school, and finding ways to get them to step into the next roles of the four-year schools, get an advanced degree, stay on to get their master's, and then come into the professional world. So I'm really happy at strides we've been making through ACEC. I know ASCE is also pushing this very hard, and there's a lot working. Now we, as members of the working engineers, we need to make sure we go back and give back where we can. So when an old professor asks you, hey, would you mind come and give a lecture? The answer's got to be yes. Right now we say, I'll get back to you, or we'll think about it. Just say yes. We'll figure it out. We'll figure out the timing. We'll figure out all this stuff, but say yes, show up, do it. If you wait for the perfect time, it's never going to be perfect, right?
I loved it. A lot of really great advice. One I heard in there, and I've heard from a lot of people, and so I just want to repeat that, but never say no, right? Try to do new things. I mean, try to learn and evolve. And it sounds like you did that in your career, right? You went from thinking you were going to be a structural engineer, but because you said yes to these other opportunities, you realized that geotech was better for you, maybe.
Yep, that's right.
Networking was a big part of it. We had John Evers on an episode as well, and we talked about the ASC scholarship program, but it sounds not just winning the scholarship, that also ended up being a networking opportunity for you, right? Because that was the reason you got to meet with the principal. I forget the name you mentioned.
Pete Chauncey, yep.
Yeah. And then being involved in the organization. And what you just did there is you gave me your secret, because I feel like every event or organization I go to or I'm part of, you are in some way senior leadership. And I'm like, how does he find the time? And I guess you've carved out the time from the beginning. So yeah. You're not trying to find new time. You have it and you're using it. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it's funny because I get that whenever I do a mentorship or like an official mentorship with someone, they're always asking me, how do you make time? How do you make time? I don't waste any minutes in a day. If I find that I have a little bit of free time later on at night or something, I find a way to fill it up, whether it's most time when it's after work hours, I try to spend it with my family as much as possible. Besides my professional life, I'm also very involved in sports with my children. So I have three kids, ages 9, 11, and 13. And I spend a lot of time with them coaching their sports. And I mean, it doesn't go without saying that it's a lot of work. It's stressful and tiresome, but I do spend most of my weekends like on a basketball court or on a baseball field, you know, coaching kids. And I absolutely love it. Some of the best moments I've had so far is just spending time with my kids in the car, talking and driving on long rides to different events. And it's great. And I know that these times you're never going to get back. So make time for it. But if my time management skills were not perfected when I was younger in my career, then this would be very tough or very stressful. So these approaches, this is not stressful for me. I always find a way to make it work. So
that's awesome. And I know you, and before we started the podcast, we were chatting a bit, and I know you're big. You coach, you said basketball and
baseball.
You have a coaching philosophy you like? Anything you impart on the kids? I know that's a little bit younger, but by 13, you're kind of
No, I mean, honestly, the things I like to echo with the children is simple. I can't coach attitude, energy. You can't coach those things. So they have to bring that to the coaching. And I always make it clear they're not wasting my time. If they're goofing around or not listening, or I make it clear they're wasting their time, right? And I think a lot of times, folks, especially when whether they're coaching someone professionally or coaching a child in a sport, they get frustrated at the process or that it's taking too long. And I'll just sit back and tell the kids very simply, I've got nothing to do on a Friday night. Like I tell them, I would rather be nowhere else than here with you in this basketball court, teaching you how to make a layup or teaching you how to dribble a basketball. This is where I want to be. So right now, the only person that's wasting your time is you, right? And I think when it comes professionally, those are the sort of words. If you're trying to jump the process or move the process faster, then you're going to skip a lot of the important details or a lot of things that kind of build up to being well-rounded. That's like trying to enter school as a freshman and try to graduate that year with a four-year degree. They call it a four-year bachelor's degree for a reason. It takes that long to get there. So I think that's the stuff I try to, and I always remind the kids that I'm coaching, whenever I stop and say, hey, what's going on? You know, they'll say, we're wasting our time. I'm like, that's right. So let's not waste your time. Let's make a good use of it. So
that's awesome. And coaches have a big impact on the lives of the kids. You know, I played a lot of sports growing up, obviously. I think most of us probably did. I read a lot about leadership, and I read a quote this morning from a coach Rupp, I believe. And the quote is, if you find someone on top of the mountain, be assured they did not fall there. And I think that's like such a cool quote. You know, it's like that person worked their way up there. So if you want to be up there too, you just got to work your way there. So
remind the kids most of the time, like if it was easy, everybody would do it, right? So
yeah. It's
for that reason. Or, oh, you're here on a Saturday morning at 8 a.m. hitting baseballs. while your friends are sitting home playing video games or doing something. They're I can assure you that they are not getting better at the sport they want to be good at if you're here doing this. So, and I think when sometimes we treat the little kids, we treat them like kids. I think there's also, you could treat them like children, but also explain to them that they're smart in a smart way. They understand it, right? Explain to it like how you would explain it to a teenager or someone in their 20s. And I think they'll say, oh, that's why we're doing this. Okay, now I want to do it, right? So.
Well, this was a great conversation. Before I let you go, I want to jump into our lightning round. So I've got four quick, short answers, but just to get to know you a little bit better. So first question, if you weren't an engineer, and we all just heard how passionate you are about engineering, what would you be doing?
I would be coaching like a college baseball, basketball, some sort of college team.
So you really love coaching. That's awesome, man.
It's really absolutely. Cool. Yeah.
All right. During a busy project, right? You're working all night. What's your go-to snack? What are you eating?
Oh, man. Well, there's probably what I should say is I enjoy eating apples or bananas or something. But the reality is, I think the salty crunchiness of peanuts or chips is probably what actually ends up happening.
All right. If they were to make a movie about your life, who would star in it?
I mean, I've always got, I say I have a face that looks like a lot of other people's faces, I think. So I get a lot of people in New York City swearing that we grew up together or swearing we were in the military together. And I have to remind them, I don't know who you are. So I think there's probably a lot of actors that look or act or have my same physical presence. So I think there's probably a list of folks that could play me.
And then last question, best way to start your day. What do you love to do first thing in the morning? On an ideal day, what would you do first thing in the morning?
I'll be frank with you. My wife got me into probably 15 years ago working out in the morning, and I go to the gym every morning. I won't tell you exactly what time, but I have a very long commute. So I wake up most of the time. I wake up very early and go to the gym. I have a good group of people that I work out with every day, and we push each other. And even when I'm traveling, I find a way to work out in the morning. It's the one time that not a lot of people are up at that time. So they're not calling you. They're not bothering you. I get an email. So it's like my go-to thing whenever I'm having, a rough day, a rough thing. It seems to be the one thing that you go back to center. And my wife does the same thing. So she goes to the gym early in the morning or goes for a run early in the morning. And I think it's a way to really center yourself and start the day with a very easy and quick win.
I'm the same way. And one of the podcasts that inspired me to start doing this is How Leaders Lead. And he would have a bunch of leaders on in different industries. And it was amazing how many of them said that the first thing they do in the morning is try to be active, right? Whether it's going to the gym or going for a walk or being out for a run. And it does change my day. Like the days I can work out in the morning, it's amazing. And one, you feel like you accomplished something right from the go and you feel positive going into whatever is next. So, well, that's amazing. I know we're pretty much perfect on time here. So I'll just do our closing, note to mention that all the links, if any, we talked about during the episode will be in the show notes. And thanks again for listening, everyone. And Art, thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. We're going to have to talk baseball and basketball next time we see each other. Go Yanks, right?
Right.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Building Better Futures. The show notes include links to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.